Good morning. Happy New Year. What do you think so far? All right, smiles.
Cold.
Smiles. All right, I consider those positive reviews. This morning I'm going to talk about a passage from Hongzhe, one of our Zen ancestors from China. I've talked about some of his passages before, and this is from one of his practice instructions from the book Cultivating the Empty Field, which was translated by Taigen Dan Leighton. If you are unfamiliar with Hongzhe or with the book Cultivating the Empty Field, I highly regard it. I really recommend it to you. It represents kind of one of the polar extremes of Chinese Zen. And Hongzhe was we don't really know, of course, but he's the one whose works are still around to come down to us as being one of the main and strongest proponents for silent illumination. And in Soto Zen, a lot of our meditation tradition, I'm reluctant to say meditation technique, but comes from the spirit of nothing to do, no place to go, nothing to fix, no step ladder, no progress, that kind of idea. And he's one of our most powerful voices that represents that tradition. So spend a little bit of time with it. The actual text that's translated is maybe 30, 40 pages. There's not much to it, actually. And when you're reading it, it's a lot like listening to talks here. It's just the same thing over and over. You miss a Sunday, you come back, oh, I didn't miss anything. It's the same talk. So there's definitely a spirit of repetition in this tradition. I think we need to be reminded a lot. So the passage I'm going to talk about today is on your programs. And for those of you who don't have one, I'll read it to you here. Silently dwell in the self, in true suchness abandon conditioning. Open-minded and bright without defilement, simply penetrate and drop off everything. Today is not your first arrival here. If your rest is not satisfying and you yearn to go beyond birth and death, there can be no such place. Just burst through and you will discern without thought dusts, pure without reasons for anxiety. Stepping back with open hands, giving up everything, is thoroughly comprehending life and death. Immediately, you can sparkle and respond to the world. Merge together with all things. Everywhere is just right. So pretty good. Right? That's pretty good. I think if I had written that passage, I would have said, I am done. The rest of my life is gravy. I am done. So Taigen, when he translated this book, gave chapter headings to each of these short chapter headings, each of these short passages, and he called this simply drop off everything. So I'll stick with that. Simply drop off everything. And that is the spirit of the passage. It's also the spirit of the entire book. It's the spirit of his teachings. It fits in with the no place to go, nothing to do, no goal to attain, no progress, because there is only everything to drop off. And it doesn't take time. It doesn't take effort. It's done. Drop off everything. So we'll talk about it line by line here. He starts by saying, silently dwell in the self. In true suchness, abandon conditioning. Open-minded and bright, without defilement, simply penetrate and drop off everything. So silently dwell in the self. So the self is truth. That's who you really are. Reality as it is. True suchness, he calls it. The suchness of things. And we can't help but dwell in the self. We have no option. We have no choice. You can't do anything other than that. And yet he's instructing you to do it. So that's interesting. I've been told a lot of times in my life by a lot of different people, just be yourself. Which sort of suggests you have another choice. Right? And we're stuck as humans in this interesting relationship with the self because on one hand, we can't ever, ever be anything other than ourselves, right? And yet, we also all know probably the sting of being inauthentic. Oh, we actually can be untrue. I actually was pretending just then. Maybe I was acting out of fear. Maybe I was acting out of shame. Maybe I was trying to hide. Maybe I was trying to cover. So I'm being myself, and yet I'm really not. You know, a lot of us have come up against some sort of a relationship, perhaps, or a job, or a circumstance in our life that reminded us, perhaps I've been living a lie. And that's weird, right? Because you'd think it would be impossible. And we seem to be the only animal on this planet with the ability to do that. I have never once in 20 years seen my cat be anything other than my cat. He has never been anything less than 100% genuine. But there have been times when I've seen myself reflected in his eyes, being, ooh, missed the mark today, not being true. So we can't help but dwell in the self because we are never anyplace else. What he's inviting us to do and what Zen practice is inviting us to do is to add awareness to that. Add awareness to that. What is it you're doing right now? Why? What is motivating that thing you want to say? Is it you? Is that really true? Is it something else? And we actually start doing this with practice and we start seeing how much of old thought patterns aren't ours, they're borrowed. How much of our speech patterns aren't true. And they're actually not us either. They're inauthentic. You know when it rubs, it feels sticky? That's not you. If it feels smooth, if there's no effort, that's a dead giveaway, it's you. Behavior patterns, jobs. We can even wake up in the morning, look in the mirror and go, I have no concept why I'm going to the place I'm about to go for 10 hours, and I've been doing it for 30 years. I hate it. It was never me. I've chosen to do it every day, never knowing. You know. So all the invitation is to add awareness. Pay attention. Pay very just gentle attention. What are the thought patterns? What are the emotion patterns? What are the speech patterns? What are the actions? What am I doing? Where is this coming from? So just adding our awareness. And what helps us with this is our intention. We talk about intention a lot in Soto Zen. We talk about vow a lot. Adding our intention to show up in this world in an authentic way, in a loving way that recognizes our interconnectedness. Our intention, our deep intention to do that helps us when the awareness shows us something we don't necessarily want to see, something hard. Our intention to move forward really helps carry us then. There's a lot of, at its best, there's a lot of loving, a lot of loving energy and even momentum to intention or to vow that helps carry us. So adding our intention, adding our awareness to our dwelling in the self. Our dwelling in the self. And perhaps, words here are clumsy. One of the things I actually love about Hongzhi is when you're reading him, I'm aware of the fact I'm reading a translation of something that he wrote. So right away there's a huge There's a huge barrier there because English and Chinese are so unbelievably different. But I'm also aware, even through the translation, I get always the sense that he's wrestling with language the best he can to try to get words to go to the place they can't go. You know, they can't quite get there, but he's trying his best he can to get there. And I think playing with words sometimes is super helpful, actually. Although they're limited in their ability to describe, to accurately describe reality, they're also perfect at describing reality. And when I'm working with this idea, dwell on the self, I prefer to phrase it as, I want to remind myself of my intention to bring awareness to the fact I'm already dwelling in the self. Otherwise, what I tend to do is I create a barrier between, oh, right, I'm doing it wrong. I want to do the thing that's right. I want to remember to dwell in the self because I'm currently not. And that's, again, absurd. Absurd. You can't not. So maybe playing with those words is helpful for you. So in true suchness, abandon conditioning. So true suchness is one of those strange sayings that comes to us. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me in English, suchness. Thusness is another one. In English, it just does not make sense outside of any kind of Zen context. In true suchness, abandon conditioning. So abandoning conditioning and true suchness are the same thing. So if you're wondering what he's talking about there, it's the process when we're in Zazen together. A lot of us just sat together here for 40 minutes. You recognize you're off. You're off. You've got a story going. You're planning. You're reviewing. You're daydreaming. Whatever. And you go, oh, right. Right, right. Zazen. Let it go. You come back. True suchness. You have just returned to a place that has no boundaries. You've actually just returned to a place where you are not. There is no self in that instant, right? Self, of course, reemerges, shows up really quickly. Ooh, right, breathing. My breathing. Ooh, and an in-breath as opposed to an out-breath. I'm back to dividing up reality again, right? It's what we do. It's cool. It's not bad. But that instant when you come back to, know you, right? Before you show up. Ah, abandon conditioning. Right? Because even ideas like breathing, in-breath, my in-breath, those are conditions. They're helpful. That's how reality shows up. That's how true suchness shows up. But again, just recognizing, oh, right, those are labels. They're distinctions. Ultimately artificial. Helpful, perhaps, but, eh. You know, so Zazen's this awesome dance between the relative and the absolute, moment after moment. You know, relative, my daydream. Relative, my plans for this evening. Back to the storyline. Oh, right. There's also the unlimited showing up right now, you know, together. Abandon conditioning. That's mindfulness. That's a word we're all getting very familiar with these days. Mindfulness is one way of talking about abandoning conditioning. We could also say ego-less awareness. The moment of awareness that's before your history, your karma, yourself is injected into it, you know, before you say, ooh, cool painting, like painting, ooh, probably from China, probably around the 1200s, ooh, maybe I even know the artist. That's cool, but that's conditioned self. So it's the moment of awareness that's precedes all that, without conditioning. And we investigate this during Zazen, you know, when we choose to drop our ideas, our conditioning, our plans, our daydreams, we're essentially dropping self, our ideas about self, and we're coming back to something. In that instant, we can't find conditioning. And curiously, when we look for self there, we can't find that either. And don't just accept that because I'm telling you that. I would encourage you to look for that. Please look for that on the cushion. But when you let go and you come back, find yourself there. See if you can. See if you can find yourself there. Is there conditioning there? Is there any kind of... Is there history there? Is there future even there? Is there time even there? All these things that are part of our conditioning. When we do this, when we let go of the narrative, whatever it is, and return to that unformed, unborn moment, you know, in that moment, look for your... Look for your memories of kindergarten or your preference for root beer or your fear of snakes or whatever that thing is that you are convinced is so part of you. Absolutely immovable. I will always prefer root beer. I have always been scared of snakes. It is part of me. It is real. And yet you can't find it right there. It's totally gone. It absolutely doesn't exist. It never has existed. So it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, this is actually playing out in the field of our experience all the time. Even people without meditation experience can recognize these. Oh, self just sort of shows up, and then it disappears. Oh, and then it shows up with all of its strings, you know, oop, and then it disappears again. True suchness. Abandon everything. And then he goes on to describe this a little bit. Open-minded and bright without defilement. It's pretty nice. Open-minded here is more than, I mean, you know, we usually think of open-minded as being, oh, come on, man, be open-minded. We're going to do this groovy thing. Yeah, it's unusual, but come on, man. At least that's what I always think of as open-minded. Like, try to listen to the Metal Machine music. You'll like it. Be open-minded. Being open-minded has gotten me into lots of trouble in my life. In any case, open-minded. I think in this case, and I don't know the Chinese characters, but mind is often the same character in Chinese as heart. Same character, Shin. We usually say Shin, you know, mind, heart, same thing. You know, this thing in our chest is part of consciousness. It's part of our Shin, mind. You know, and in our culture, we usually think mind is a synonym for brain. You know. So what's on your mind usually means what are you currently thinking about. So if I say, what's on your mind? And you say, I'm really sad. No, I didn't ask that. I don't want to know about your feelings. Just tell me what you're thinking about. I can get some traction there. Come on, I'm a guy. So Shin, mind, very big, open mind, open heart. Open mind, open heart. No conditions. Bright without defilement. I can't put words in his mouth, but if I were to, I would suggest he would never believe in defilement in the first place. But he's playing with language again here. We sometimes talk about how, you know, we have karmic consciousness or conditioned consciousness as a result of our history, you know. I have a certain perception on the world because of when I was born, to whom I was born, my genetic predisposition, my race, my gender, my education, all that kind of stuff. And even though I'm telling you, in that moment when you're in Zazen and you drop all that and you come back to just this, there is no history, there is no gender, there is no race, there is no time, there is none of that stuff. At least in my experience, it isn't that those two things are in any way in opposition, and it's not that they are opposed. And it isn't that you're in reality one and then you click into reality two. This is the way experience, this is the way consciousness shows up. And it's a little bit more like the right and left foot in walking. Right? They are two expressions of the same reality. So again, I'm just encouraging you the way he is to not divide. The brightness and the defilement are not in opposition, the way light and dark are not in opposition. Right? So don't get caught by, I mean, defilement, that's kind of a loaded word. It's not my favorite. Oh, I've got defilements. I better get rid of them so then I'm pure. And he's really not creating this dichotomy. He's reminding you the nature of consciousness itself is bright. It is unoccluded. It can't ever possibly be. So it isn't that when thoughts insert themselves, you are defiled. Right, that's one of the things that actually evolves quite a bit in Chinese Zen is this sort of tension, this debate between is the idea to brush the mirror clean or is the idea to see there's no mirror to start with? And they both represent very, very, at least from my point of view, useful practice models. Right? The danger of the there's nothing to do, there's no mirror is that you don't have to do anything. I can go out and hit somebody in the face. What difference does it make, baby? There's no face, there's no fist. Like, no, I think you have to probably sit down and think about what you've just done. You've caused suffering. Suffering's real. On the other hand, if I get too caught by the, oh, I have to get rid of it. Oh, I have to get rid of it. Oh, I have to get rid of it. Oh, there's greed. Oh, God, I'm so bad. I got to get rid of it. Well, now I get caught again, right, by striving, grasping, by a worldview that starts with not good enough or by a worldview that starts with broken, must fix, you know. So I'm glad there's a creative tension. It's never resolved, by the way. This is, it's not like we ever figured this out at some point and went, oh, right, this is the correct one. Those guys were wrong. This is just watching the nature of consciousness, you know, showing up in these two ways. Conditioned self, wow, cool. Dramatic. All of our drama, we love our drama. That's part of it. Ooh, we get it. And at the same time remembering, oh, that's how emptiness shows up. It shows up as form. It shows up as form. So abandon conditioning. It isn't fancy. It sounds fancy, but it isn't. It isn't far away. It sounds far away, but it isn't. It's already your mind. In fact, it would be better to say it's already mind. Abandon conditioning, in this case, and use, you know, these are practice instructions. He's actually trying to instruct you, and this is what you do on the cushion. It feels like prose to me because it's so lofty, but these are like practical. This is what you're supposed to do. So when he says abandon conditioning, he is saying there is something to be done, and it's don't insert yourself in your zazen. We hear that a lot in Zen. Go to the cushion, but don't bring yourself there. You know, whether it's Suzuki or Katagiri, I've read them both and I get them confused. Your zazen is none of your business. Don't make it yours. Don't make it yours. Oh, I get it. That's me inserting it. And then it's me wanting it. And that's me owning it, trying to squeeze something out of it. I get it. I think it was Katagiri, because I think it was Suzuki who said, don't ever think you sit zazen. Zazen sits zazen. They're saying the same thing. Don't own it. It's not yours. Don't bring yourself there. Just get to the cushion and then drop off conditioning. Abandon everything. True suchness. Simply penetrate and drop off everything. So this is just zazen. Another way of talking about this is to transcend and include. I mentioned include, the transcend and include thing, because a lot of us come to, myself included, a lot of us come to or came to spiritual practice as a way of escaping a lot of other stuff. Whatever those details are yours. But a lot of us come to spiritual practice looking for a spiritual bypass. I got a lot of ego suffering. I got a lot of karma suffering. I got a lot of family issues. I've got addiction. I've got shame. I've got whatever your deal is. And I'm going to go to a spiritual center and get myself some enlightenment. And I'm going to do an end run around all that mucky stuff because it's about transcending, right? I'm going to leave all this behind. And when we start doing zazen for any length of time, we realize, oh, wow, was I wrong. Because all I ever see showing up moment after moment on the wall in front of me or the floor in front of me is that exact stuff I came here to escape from. And now it's in stark relief because I have no other distractions. I can't turn on the TV. I can't surf the net. I'm staring at a wall. Zazen is designed to be as naked as possible to show you exactly all that stuff. So I'm mentioning this here because on the Zafu, when we are doing zazen, we don't ignore anything. You have to include everything that shows up. You have to, have to, have to. It's not going anywhere. It'll keep coming. It'll keep coming. That thing you're trying to get away from will keep coming. So it's why we talk about in zazen instruction that delicate line that we all walk between not pushing something away, but not grabbing on and feeding. And we notice ourselves on the cushion, essentially leaning a little too far to one side and then a little too far to the other. We kind of go back and forth a bit. But, ooh, there's a feeling, a thought, a memory, an idea I don't like, and I watch myself push it away. Okay, so there's aversion showing up. I'm not allowing it. There's a feeling that just showed up that I wouldn't let myself feel. Right? Versus the opposite of, ooh, I like that daydream. I was lost in that daydream for like 10 minutes. Laura rang the bell, and I was like, oh, right, back again. Oh, I love that daydream. I fed it, you know. And so we're always kind of doing this lovely balancing act between don't feed it, but don't push it away. And, of course, that's teaching us equanimity. You know, it's teaching us uprightness. That's what they mean when they say upright. But it's good to remind ourselves that it isn't that you don't include something. When grief shows up in my body during zazen, when grief shows up in my body during zazen, letting that go which is what they would say, well, just let it go. Don't feed it. Let it go. That doesn't mean don't feel it. It means don't feed it. But when grief shows up, you feel grief. That's what's happening in the field of your experience. It doesn't mean I have to feed it to remind myself, oh, yeah, God, it really was so bad. Oh, and it was this, too. Now I'm generating the feeling, right? I'm actually generating the feeling. No, I don't want to do that. But it's shown up. It doesn't mean I will not feel it. And I think we oftentimes equate letting something go with it not being there. Like, if you've successfully let it go, then it never shows up. You never think about it. You never feel it. If there's still energy there, and that grief is unresolved, and it's part of the field of your karmic consciousness, and it shows up, you feel it. You feel it. You know? Don't feed it, but don't push it away. It's showing up as a feeling. And that's part of Zazen, right? If the mind he's talking about includes this, what we call heart, if Shin includes both the 3 pounds of gray in our skull and this beautiful red, tender beating heart, then that's part of it. That is part of it. And so same thing with thoughts, of course. When a lot of us come to meditation, I'm not sure where we get this, but I had this idea really, really. Like, the idea was not to think. I have to laugh because I'm like 98% of the people I ever talk to are like, oh, I thought the idea was not to think. And I can't, like, stop, so I'm really bad at this. This is for you guys. You guys are really good at that. That's awesome, but I am afflicted with this hyperactive brain. I'm like, oh, yeah, you and 7 billion other people, honey. So same thing with thoughts. They show up. It isn't that the idea is to not think, but feeding the thought is different than just allowing it to play out its little dance and leave when it's ready to leave. So it's a very light touch, right? So I actually like the image of letting go, because all it means is open hand. Open hand. Right? It doesn't mean push away, but it doesn't mean grab. It just means open hand. So in the Grassroof Hermitage, when he says, open your hands and walk innocent, he's talking about exactly the same thing. Open your hands. It doesn't mean you have to push away anything. Your innocence doesn't depend on you not having a past, because that's not possible. Your fundamental innocence is right here. He says, open-minded and bright without defilement. That's all he's talking about. Open your hands. Open your hands. So, drop off, when he says drop off, that just means non-attachment, which is what we're talking about, not grabbing. To drop off is to see non-separateness. That's probably a made-up word. Maybe I could say it, to drop off is to not see separation. When we drop a narrative during Zazen and come back to something, we're coming from a place of separation to a place of non-separation. To drop off is to see non-separateness or interbeing. Because for us to attach to something is to make it separate. If I'm attached to something, or it's opposite, if I have aversion to something, I am making it separate. It's easier to see when it's aversion. You know, if I really hate that guy, I'm going out of my way to make sure we're separate. Right? Because I see something in that person that I so don't want to be. It would be shameful for me to recognize that quality in myself, which is where aversion comes from. You are absolutely separate. I am for sure not you. Right? That's why we're so fond of making villains. Because if there's a villain and we're not them, guess who we get to be? Dun 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 dun. We do this all the time. We insist upon separateness because we don't want to. But attachment's the flip side of the very same coin. If I'm really attached to that thing, to that person, I'm making it separate. It has to be separate in order for me to be attached to it. I'm viewing it as other. I'm making it apart. And, of course, this is correct. It is separate. But it's also not. Right? There's Zen. Not one, not two. Not one, not two. You aren't the same. And you're not different. Just like they talk about self. Like, right? So in Buddhism, I am not you. And I know this because I'm doing this to my knee and you can't feel it. Oh, I know that we're separate. That's true. It's also not true, because when you weep, I feel something. My heart constricts. My tears well up. Oh my God, if we were actually separate, I would have no such response. That's interesting. We're not one, and we're not two. Right? Wow. I can't figure it out up here at all, because this thing between my ears is a more or less binary machine, so I don't get it up here, but I do get it down here. And I can't really explain that knowing, but I think all of us certainly understand how we are together, how we are one, and how we're not one at the same time. There's not a contradiction there. Reality isn't full of paradoxes. Our brain just filters them in such a way that they appear to be paradoxes, right? Because down here I get that. I really get that. So he says something that I think is really wonderfully warm. Today is not your first arrival here. Today is not your first arrival here. This reminds me of all those things in my life, and a lot of them happened in this building, actually. The things that I have learned that I knew I had never heard before, but for some reason when they were said, I went, right, I've always known that. I've always known that. It's never not been true, and I didn't know that I knew it until just now. Have you guys ever, I'm sure you've, yeah, it's like, of course I've always known that, and now I know that I know that. It's coming back to this moment as it is, to truth, to reality. And we always recognize it because it's home. It's home. And of course, it's never been. The moment you're having right now has never happened, will never happen again. It's fundamentally unknowable. It's also fundamentally foreign to you because you've never been here. And yet, we experience it as home. I like thinking about Zazen that way. When you get lost, come home again. When you get lost, come home again. Have you ever been there before? No, heavens no. But, oh yes, you've never left it. You've never, ever, ever left it. That's how you recognize it so deeply. So, of course, it's not your first arrival here. You've never been anywhere else. If your rest is not satisfying and you yearn to go beyond birth and death, there can be no such place. Now, that's a great sentence, and it took me by surprise because the first half of it, I thought, oh, I know where he's going with this. You'd think after reading a certain number of Zen books, you'd stop thinking, oh, I know where they're going with this, because they're never going there. But nope, I'm incorrigible. I don't learn. If your rest is not satisfying and you yearn to go beyond birth and death, I expect him to say, then join us in this practice and you too can dun-dun-dun-dun. And instead it was like, then there can be no such thing. I'm like, oh, but dude, that's why I'm here. That's the whole point of this, is to go beyond birth and death. I notice my rest isn't satisfying, and now you're telling me there can be no such place. Well, there's a lot here. There's a lot in this sense. But where I went with this is that not satisfying, he says, if your rest is not satisfying and you yearn, not satisfying is discontent. It's a feeling we are all very, very intimate with. Discontent. It is wanting something to be different, something big, maybe something very small. Wanting something to be different is feeling unsatisfied. This is the experience we all have when we feel small and needy. And we don't feel large, and we don't feel at peace. Because we are wanting, we are grasping, we are desiring, we're yearning. So if you yearn to go beyond, there can be no such place. The yearning itself is constricting me. It's keeping me small. Desire obscures reality. It's an expression of reality, too, but in the moment we experience desire as obscuring reality is the moment in which we experience desire as dissatisfaction and suffering, which is what the first or the second noble truth is about, third noble truth. The noble truth is about when desire becomes grasping and attachment, we suffer. The world gets small. It reifies self. It reifies separation. It reifies some sort of fundamental sense that we lack. that the wheel, the great wheel of our lives is out of balance. And we're missing something. So the place beyond birth and death, beyond these splits, beyond duality, vanishes when we grasp for it. Because when we seek, we are far away, as the Shenzhen Ming says. When you seek, you are far away. This is one of those lovely things that's kind of, again, kind of intuitive on some level, but that our brains struggle with about how, you know, the best way to catch a butterfly is to sit really still and it lands on you, if you're lucky. But the faster you run to chase it, the faster it flies away. There's a saying in Zen, don't try to catch a feather with a fan. Which is that same thing, like, if I could just blow a little harder, I could catch the feather. And they're like, well, that's hilarious, because you will never ever, like, the harder you blow, the farther, it's a feather. So he's encouraging us, as he does, he's a very, very gentle voice, and he's encouraging us to remind our aching hearts and our busy minds that the cushion can be a place of refuge from urgency. It can be a place of refuge from the constriction that comes with grasping and being loud and urgent. We live in a very loud, urgent world, in case you didn't notice. And usually the louder and more urgent you are, the more successful you are in some fields of getting the thing that you're supposed to get that's supposed to solve all your problems and make your teeth whiter. But in reality, you realize, well, I was loud and urgent, I got what I wanted, and 5 minutes later I'm finding myself needing to be loud and urgent again because another need has arisen, and it turns out contentment only lasted 5 minutes, and then, which is what usually brings us to a center like this. At some point you realize, oh my God, it doesn't work. I can't keep being louder. And again, because these are practice instructions, he's saying, let your zazen be as still as a feather. Like a still candle flame, they sometimes say, that doesn't move in the wind. And, you know, if we're looking for a feather with a fan and we just turn off the fan, if I stop looking for the feather that way, if I let my zazen be as still as a feather, then I don't have to keep looking. I don't have to keep looking anymore. I've found that in myself. I think it's one of the reasons that posture actually is emphasized so much in the Zen tradition, that, you know, we take a posture that's upright. We take a posture that's stable. We take a posture that's comfortable. We take a posture that is balanced, because then I don't need to look for any of those things. I have them in my felt experience, in my bones. Even if my mind is, my brain, is wandering all over the place, where's equanimity? I don't have to go very far. I'm sitting up straight. You know, and 5 minutes ago I was really sad, and then I had a memory, and then I got happy, and then I was bored, and then I was thinking about Downton Abbey. And then, but in the midst of it, I'm absolutely still. I'm totally still. I'm upright. I am balanced. I'm comfortable. I don't have to look for balance in my life. I have balance. I don't have to look for stability. I have it. Where's my equanimity? Right here. And isn't it brilliant that my equanimity isn't dependent on the story going away, the feelings not arising? That my equanimity is so close, it actually doesn't move or sway at all when feelings show up, memories show up, the mind is busy. It doesn't care. Doesn't care. You know, it's the cloud sky metaphor. You know, no matter how crazy the clouds are and black and full of rain and full of lightning and full of energy, the sky holds them. No problem. They leave no mark when they're gone. Just like your zazen, you know, the bell rings. Those memories you had, the crazy busy mind, the grief, the anger, the boredom, poof. No mark. No mark is left on your mind. Bright without defilement. And again, it's not to say we don't have to deal with those things. When grief arises, how can I skillfully deal with grief? How can I feel grief? How can I transform it so I can be of service to others? That doesn't mean ignore, but it really helpful for us to remind ourselves that we aren't defined by those things. We aren't limited by them. We aren't marked by them. That so much of our nature is forever undefiled, forever bright. So we needn't yearn to go beyond birth and death, Or perhaps it'd be better to say, we need to yearn just enough to get to the cushion. Just get to the cushion. And then we don't have to chase anything. Just burst through and you will discern without thought dusts. Pure without reasons for anxiety. Stepping back with open hands, giving up everything, is thoroughly comprehending life and death. When we let go of self, in that moment, we are innocent of self. To thoroughly give up self is to thoroughly comprehend life and death. Only the self is subject to life and death. And the self is a fiction. We have thoroughly comprehended life and death by just letting go. And when we're thinking about this, it might be helpful to ask, you know, that part of you that wants to let go of yourself, ask that part. Who is this self that wants to let go of self? That's interesting. Is there a self that wants to let go of self? Is there someone letting go? Is there actually a subject and an object? The invitation of Zen meditation at some point is to go beyond the split of subject and object, right? Subject and object is where we live most of our lives. That's really, really super helpful for us. Mindfulness is subject-object. I am aware. There is an observer. This sensation is arising. I am observing it. Ah, wonderful. There's still a split, though. At what point does that split heal itself and stop being real? At what point is there no seer and no seen? At what point is there just experience, pure experience? There is no one letting go of self because there is no self to let go of. And these are just questions, and they're useless to you. So please investigate them with your own experience, because these are the things that only in our body, our bones, our experience, can we approach or be transformed by. Ideas don't transform us, but the way that experience does. So I'm encouraging you to be intimate with your practice, with your life, with your zazen. I think that our minds are amazingly powerful. I think thought is tremendously powerful. I think it can be very helpful. I also believe thought is limited. And thought can tell us a lot about the shape of reality. But I don't think reality can be known in the way we want to know it, through thought. Only love, I think, can do that. Intimacy, we would say, in Zen, can do that. So I encourage you to spend time with this verse if it's helpful to you. If it's not, don't worry about it. Recycle it. But he leaves you with the idea that responding to the world is our duty, is our obligation as beings, and he reassures us that everywhere is just right. And I ask you that, or I ask you to investigate the possibility that maybe he's telling you the truth. Perhaps everywhere is just right. And perhaps this everywhere where you live can hold all of your suffering and all of your difficulty without any problem. And there is no separation between you and the everywhere that is just right. So that's as much as I have, I think, to say this morning. And I thank you for your attention. I think we have just about 3 minutes, maybe, for questions. If anybody has a question or a comment or something. Marcia.
I think it's a typo, but it says simply penetrate and drop off everything.
Open-minded and bright without defilement, simply penetrate and drop off everything.
Simply penetrate.
Well, there's a few different places we could go with it. The way I see it is the last three steps of the Eightfold Path, 6, 7, and 8, effort, mindfulness, and concentration or absorption, kind of talk about three of the general headings, three of the general ways in which we work with mind in Buddhism. Right effort, I think of, we're working with the contents of consciousness, changing messages, working with messages, that kind of stuff. Seven, mindfulness, just observe. Ego-less awareness, just observe, right? Before the label, before the whatever. And then finally, eight, concentration or absorption, I think of as when the observer disappears. Penetrate. Essentially, like when you read Cultivating the Empty Field, he's basically saying over and over and over and over, just go all the way in. Just go. There aren't steps. There aren't some techniques. None of that stuff. Just be it. Which I think for a certain type of person would really be super helpful, because it kind of short circuits the comparing, judging. Oh, she's doing better than I am. Maybe I need to sit up straighter. But I'm guessing for a lot of us, that's not enough. There, go. Just penetrate reality. What? Oh, you missed it. Do it again. But I don't know. You are reality. Just be it. Well done. It is a little. It's quite direct. It's quite direct. I hope that is helpful. But yeah, he's encouraging us. Yes, drop everything we would call conditioning. That is to say, you know, mindfulness. Drop all your ideas. Blah blah blah. But he's wanting you to go all the way in. Drop even the observer. There's no observer. There's no self-observing. Penetrate. That's my guess. Thank you. It's a good question. Jeff.
Thank you for your talk, Martin.
Oh, you're welcome.
I think there's something missing.
Hmm.
These instructions are about life on the cushion.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is true that all of the stuff that we seem to be involved with comes up when we're sitting on the cushion. The things we're afraid of, the things we want, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also another dimension that we're just, most of the time, completely not aware of. And it's part of the condition itself.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me, but for most of us, I think that life that we're not aware of is our lives as white people.
Oh, yeah.
And we really need to understand all the blindness that implies, and that means there's work off the cushion that needs to be done as well. We need to investigate, what is it like to be not white in this mm-hmm. world today?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I think one of the criticisms that's probably been fairly leveled against the 2,500 years, roughly, of Buddhist history is that it tends to err toward the side of quietude and non-involvement. Mm-hmm. You know, we were so busy
it's
on the cushion.
It's just a question of non-involvement. It's mm-hmm. just a question of deepening the understanding of the condition itself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a universal aspect to Buddhism, which is great, mm-hmm. absolutely true. It's necessary. Mm-hmm. It's not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the investigation of the condition self. For a lot of us, I think, has to come before the dropping away. Because it's not like it's not going to keep arising, right? It keeps showing up.
Well,
we have to keep seeing it.
That's
yeah. Yeah. Awareness is always the key, isn't it? To touching these things. Yeah. That's very true. Thank you, Jeff. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay. I think I will turn it over to you, Laura-san.
Thank you.